then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's July the 29th, 2010. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. I want to begin this week's show with a quick reminder. You folks out there can send me your feedback on Radio Free Northwest either by emailing me personally at nwnet@earthlink.net, or you can go to the party website at www.northwestfront.org. Click on the Radio Free Northwest tab at the top of the page, and you'll see that beside each week's broadcast in the download section, it's just like the blog, complete with a comments section. I need as much feedback as I can get on these broadcasts. They're one of the few things that our race has going by way of opposition to the mightiest, most pervasive, and most poisonous monopoly on communications the world has ever seen. One of our listeners told me she enjoys listening to Radio Free Northwest because it lets her know that we do, in fact, have a team on our side and that we're at least batting back. Well, that's the idea. These shows generally run a little short of an hour because I think that's the optimum time, as long as I can reasonably expect to hold your attention. I know you guys don't have the time or the inclination to listen to me drone on and on for 5 hours like Fidel Castro. I'd like to hear from you, not just to hear what you think about the show, but to let me know how I can make the best use of that time. Next comes our weekly Edgar Steele update. My own second letter to Edgar Steele was recently returned by the Spokane County Jail. The envelope did not appear to have been opened, and it bore a received rubber stamp dated July the 19th. The red return to sender rubber stamp says, requires full name or address. Now, the address and the prisoner number I sent the letter to was the address and number given to me by Kelsey Steele, and also listed on the Spokane County Jail's website, and I made it a point to handwrite my own return address quite clearly, using my name and not Northwest Publishing, so that's not the problem. Now understand, there is no possibility of an honest mistake here on the part of some knuckle-headed Spokane County deputy or jailer in the mailroom. I scrupulously followed all the rules for prisoner correspondence. I did not tape the letter shut, which can sometimes cause an envelope to be returned by a correctional institution. I didn't do anything like that. Somebody in authority has just plain decided that I am not to be allowed to correspond with Edgar Steele. I've run across all the various excuses for returning prisoner mail before, especially in the case of our woman comrade Pamela Bailey. So there were no coffee stains, no tape on the envelope, nothing like that. They just plain aren't giving Ed Steele his mail, or at least not all of it. And so that makes one wonder just what the hell it is they're afraid of or what they're trying to do. Now we can be absolutely assured that every scrap of mail Mr. Steele is allowed to receive is photocopied and turned over to the prosecution, as well as all his outgoing mail. They're deliberately trying to keep him isolated for a reason. Now, the first thought that comes to mind is that the regime is trying to break him psychologically so he'll cop a plea bargain, which means that they know their case is damned weak and neither their informant Larry Fairfax nor their so-called tapes can stand up to too much examination. Now, a quick word on another subject. This morning when I logged onto my computer, I turned to Matt Drudge, and the first thing I see is a story about how some synagogue in Montgomery County, Maryland, has been spray-painted with swastikas, complete with long interviews with various sobbing Jews moaning about how persecuted they are. Aye, the pain, the 6 million, why do they hate us so? You get the idea. I'm sure we've all seen this kind of thing down through the years, and I don't know what it's like now, but 30 years ago it used to be that Silver Spring, Maryland was the big Jewish government suburb, and for that reason, back in my Franklin Road days, we used to get all kinds of incidents like this up there. Every time it happened, the cops would come riding down to Arlington and rattle our cages. I think they knew that in most cases the Jews were doing it themselves, but they were hoping for some excuse to arrest one of our guys for anything. Now, most likely, like so many of this kind of incident, this was the Jews doing it themselves to their own shinigog in order to kill two birds with one stone, i.e. get sympathy for the poor, persecuted little Hebrews and scam some insurance money for a new jacuzzi on the rabbi's patio. So-called hate crimes that have in fact been fabricated by their alleged victims are now as common as dirt, and they have indeed become so common that any time one's reported, the police routinely investigate the alleged victim as well. They caught some Jew female college student doing the same thing at her university a few weeks ago, in fact, although my memory fails me as to details and I'm too lazy to look it up. But just in case, guys, do I really need to explain to you out there just how moronic this kind of thing is? Don't do it! Don't deface synagogues. Don't deface Jewish anything. Don't desecrate Jewish cemeteries. Don't commit acts of stupid and childish vandalism that will get you almost as much prison time as if you actually killed one of the sons of bitches, and that just creates sympathy for these evil people who deserve none. Now, why in God's name am I even saying this? Why do I have to say it? That's one of the worst things about the movement. Why do I have to be constantly explaining the obvious? I cannot think of anything we can do that is more counterproductive than this kind of publicity, which is probably why the Jews and the niggers do it to themselves so often and claim to be victims. Now let me spell this out for you in words of one syllable. Do not do this crap. Are we clear on this? Good. One more thing before we get on with the emails. Does anyone have an update for me on the case of that poor kid who was arrested about 6 months ago by the FBI for the horrible crime of posting a poem on newsaxon.org? I'm ashamed to say that I've forgotten his name, and I can't seem to find anything about him on Google or in any of my old emails. I don't suppose he's come to trial yet, or did they just give him an Edgar Steele Rush job I haven't heard about? You know, what's happening there? Anybody who knows anything about this, please shoot me an email at nwnet@earthlink.net. The first email this week comes from Frank in Indiana. Dear HAC, in your books and in your assorted internet writings, you have on several occasions remarked on what you refer to as the extended adolescence that young white males often undergo in this society. I think you may have a very valid point there. It's something I've noticed in the past few decades in dealing with people in my workplace and which I've observed in my friends and relatives. Could you elucidate, please? Sure, Frank. Like many white people whose brains haven't been completely turned to tapioca pudding by the Jews and their television, I've spent many years examining the world around me and trying to figure out how the hell we ever ended up in this mess. There's no one single answer. The degeneration of the white man from a race of creators and conquerors into a race of Homer Simpsons and Peter Griffins is the result of a lot of interrelated phenomenon. It's really tempting to blame it all on the Jews, but the fact is that when it comes right down to brass tacks, we are the ones who have allowed the Jews to do this to us. You can't really blame the Jews for acting according to their nature any more than you can blame a cobra for striking, but you can damn sure blame the idiot who allows his home to become overrun with cobras while he sits on his ass on the veranda and does nothing about it. For the past 50 years or so, and especially since the 1970s and 1980s, one of the primary traits of modern white boys has been irresponsibility and a refusal to live in the real world. I think this is, at least to some degree, part of a deliberate policy on the part of the Jews who control our government and our cultural institutions, and who write our society's narrative, as the latest buzzword goes. Young white American males have been bombarded from a very early age with ideas and propaganda, and above all, with electronic images intended to condition them into certain kinds of passive and deracinated behavior patterns, beginning with Sesame Street and the pervasive children's cartoons when they're toddlers, and then on through years of television, movies, and other social engineering techniques. I'm just paranoid enough to suspect that the Jews deliberately created an alternative Dungeons and Dragons type universe online and in fantasy TV and movies for white boys to play in, and where they can lose both their personal and their racial identities, a whole alternate fantasy where it's all pleasure and adventure and no hard work and responsibility, where white boys can become someone other than who they are and don't have to worry about the real world and real problems. And that's what many of them do. More than once I've heard white boys come up with some kind of variation on, "Reality blows, man. I like my online life better." I can understand the incredible attractions of that world. If the internet and online gaming and role-playing had been available when I was a teenager, I might have jumped into it with both feet as well. So eager was I for anything at all to escape the horrors of Chapel Hill High School. Instead, in those days, I had to fall back on good old-fashioned books, where I actually learned things, although not the crap the power structure wanted me to learn. But I can totally relate to how it's happened with so many other young white male adolescents and young men. If the girl you've had a crush on since 7th grade is now a crack whore screwing niggers down on the corner, or else she's at some liberal arts university in the process of being turned into a bitter man-hating feminist, and while you yourself couldn't beat the race and gender quotas or get a scholarship like girls can, and so you're stuck at home going to the local community college and delivering pizzas or working in a stockroom for some temp agency, if that's the case, then I can understand why such a white boy goes online when he gets home at night and becomes a warrior dwarf with magic powers who can kill ogres with balls of blue fire. And for the Jew, that's a hell of a lot preferable to having white boys trying to kill the real ogres. The white boy or man who never makes it out of adolescence is now a generally recognized figure of fun in popular culture. He's been around for a while. There was a song back in the 70s that had a line, "You know, my heart keeps telling me you're not a kid at 33. Then there are famous examples like Homer and the comic book guy on The Simpsons. And you remember the whole Star Trek, Star Wars fan phenomenon? Today the media poke fun at your typical Trekkie or Star Wars obsessive who still lives in his parents' basement at age 40 with his Spock ears, his plastic toy lightsaber, and his computer. Okay, that's a bit of an extreme example, but we all know that guys like that exist, and there's enough truth in that caricature to hurt. And of course, there are other forms of immaturity than online and video games addiction, other forms of white refusal to grow up. Mostly white male refusal to grow up, although I know girls are susceptible to this too, just not, I think, to as great a degree. There's drinking and drugs and the endless sense of drift that many young white people have. One of the scariest things I think a parent or anybody can hear is when you ask some 16 or 17-year-old high school kid what his or her major is going to be in college, and they reply, "Oh, I don't know, whatever." A 17-year-old young man or young woman with no purpose and no idea what they want to do with their lives is a sure sign that somebody has failed badly somewhere along the way. I'm sure all of us are familiar with the phenomenon of white kids getting married way too young, as the saying goes, and the marriage breaks up due to one or both spouses' inability to grow up, stop drinking, stop partying, stop blowing dope, stop screwing around, start working, and start getting serious about life, like it's one big Porky's movie. Usually it's the husband, true, but sometimes the wife is just as sleazy and immature, and sometimes there's a couple of kids involved by the time the divorce comes around, God help them. 50% of all marriages end in divorce, and since a lot fewer blacks bother to get married, Mexicans divorce very seldom, and Asians almost never, those casualty statistics are mostly white. This idea that, oh, they got married too young is bullshit. They didn't get married too young, they just weren't old enough when they got married, if you get the subtle difference I'm referring to. White kids just plain don't grow up and become men and women fast enough. Now, why does this happen? What the hell caused such a phenomenon? I know this is going to sound very cliche, but like most cliches, it's actually true. The fact is that the United States has just come out of possibly the longest period of unbroken peace and certainly prosperity in history. It used to be you had the army to worry about at age 18, but since 1972, that's no longer true. And much to my surprise, it looks like it won't be true for a while longer at least. Apparently, the mighty United States of America, land of the free and home of the brave, still doesn't have sufficient trust in the loyalty of its citizens so that they don't dare to conscript an army. With some exceptions among the remaining blue-collar class, white boys are never forced by necessity to grow up. A lot of them spend the first one-third of their lives going to school, 12 years of public or private school up to high school graduation, then comes 4 years to get a bachelor's degree, and then another 2 to 4 years to get a master's or some other specialist degree, and then maybe another 4 years to get a PhD in some cases, allowing for a miscellaneous year or two spent dicking around, backpacking around Europe, or snowboarding in Aspen, or more likely just delivering pizzas by night and sitting in the basement playing online games by day, and the average white boy 27 or 28 years old before the pressure to get a real job and get out of his parents' house and actually become a man becomes really acute. And even then, a lot of times, these overgrown teenagers never really grow up. I mean, look at Bill Clinton. I've already told you guys the story about the techie nerds in their late 20s and 30s bringing their childhood toys to work in their cubicles, so I won't repeat that. But what is chilling is that every time I do tell that story, I get confirmations from a lot of you listeners who have seen the same thing in your own workplaces. You know, this long, drawn-out adolescence thing is a very recent development. Only in this luxurious world that America has created for the past century or so has it become the fashion to say that age 21 is adulthood. In the past, when the average lifespan was about 50, if you were lucky, our people have always had to grow up a lot quicker than that. In the pioneer days, a boy was pretty much a man at 16, and a girl was a woman even younger. In the Middle Ages, boys were apprenticed to a trade around the age of 7, and they became adult journeymen at 16 or so, depending on the trade. Girls were usually engaged by the age of 12 and married at age 13 or 14 in marriages arranged by their parents. Among the upper classes, it was not at all uncommon for men like Edward, the Black Prince of Wales, and Sigismondo Malatesta, the Lord of Rimini in Italy, to command armies at the age of 16 and win battles. In 1783, William Pitt the Younger became Prime Minister of Great Britain at the age of 24. Lucky for us, because Pitt was the prime minister who signed off on American independence. In our own Civil War, 19- and 20-year-old colonels on both sides were by no means unknown, and George Armstrong Custer made Brigadier General in the Union Army at the age of 23, while William Paul Roberts of North Carolina also made General in the Confederate Army at the same age. The point I'm trying to make here is that maturity and preparation for adult life are not something biological. They're one of those things that's purely cultural and environmental, something that we can take control of and change if we create a new society in the Northwest Republic that understands the necessity to make responsibility a part of every young man and woman's upbringing. I think a very good way to start is with Section 5, Article 1 of the Northwest Constitution. All able-bodied male citizens and residents of the Northwest American Republic must serve a basic term of active duty in the armed forces and a set term in the reserves. I went into the Army myself at age 17, and so I made damn sure that was in there. And ladies, you ain't getting off the hook either. Section 5, Article 2 mandates the same 2 years of alternative national service for girls. Although, as far as I'm concerned, the NDF can have special female units for women who want to serve their race and their country in the military. None of this politically correct madness of mixing the sexes within the units, though. Now, there's something to be said for a young man simply being thrown into the deep end at age 16 or 17 and made to sink or swim. Me, I had no choice. My father threw me out of the house when I graduated high school at age 17, and I had no option but to volunteer for the Army. In many ways, I now believe that it's the best thing he could have done for me, although that certainly wasn't his intention. I have two brothers, both of whom towed the official line and applied the lips in the prescribed manner, both at home and in politically correct society, and who accordingly, all their lives, reaped all the benefits of wealth and the American lifestyle, which I did not. And today, I have to admit, I'm jealous of their medical insurance, but other than that, they don't have a damn thing I want. And judging how they turned out, I wouldn't trade places with either of them. I take my middle brother, for example, and no, I'm not just airing my family's dirty laundry here. I'm choosing him because this guy is actually, in some respects, a pretty good and typical example of a 21st century white male whose life story demonstrates how we got into the mess we got into today. Now, my brother spent 10 years in college at God knows what kind of expense to the family. He may have gotten a few scholarships or he may not have, I don't know. We haven't spoken for 21 years, and last time we did, he was screaming threats and abuse into the phone, so we really didn't have time to catch up on our respective backstories, so I admit there's some gaps here. Anyway, my brother spent 10 years in multiple universities in order to get a bachelor's and a master's degree in musical composition of all the god-awful useless things. According to his own online resume, he then failed to take his doctorate after 2 more years of quote-unquote postgraduate studies for whatever reason. Who knows, maybe my father finally got tired of footing the bills for a 30-year-old man who was, by then, pretty clearly never ever going to make his way in the world. Although, to be fair, he had other issues as well, which pretty much ensured that gainful employment was never on the cards for him. Those issues, by the way, were also largely attributable to growing up in a politically correct liberal democracy. Like I said, I'm not here to run down my brother. I'm simply using him because he's an example I'm familiar with. Now, the simple fact is that, so far as I can determine, he's never worked a day in his life. By that, I don't mean tuning pianos or cutting firewood with a chainsaw for his Franklin stove. I mean, never in his life, again, so far as I can determine, has my brother been forced to hear that alarm go off in the morning, drag his ass out of bed, drive through horrible traffic to some place he doesn't really want to be, and for the next 8 hours do really stupid crap with stupid people, and then drive home through the traffic again and get up the next day and do it all over. Because if he didn't, he wouldn't be able to pay the rent on the first of the month and he'd end up living in his car. Now, I have done that. and there's no doubt in my mind that I'm a better man for it. My younger brother played it a little bit smarter. When he couldn't cut it in New York, he came back to North Carolina and went to work for the state, which is basically in North Carolina where you go if you can't cut it in the private sector. He put it on cruise control, and now he's presumably cruising down the home stretch to his pension. Unless, of course, the state of North Carolina goes bankrupt like so many other states do, thanks to the Democrats' subprime mortgage monkey shines leading to the present Democratic Depression. And neither of my brothers has had any children of their own. I've produced 5, maybe 6. Apparently, there is something about poverty that tends towards reproduction of the species, and something about middle-class affluence that reduces or stunts reproduction altogether, which is weird. You'd think the reverse would be the case, but apparently not, at least not in this country. My middle brother has produced some musical compositions, fair enough, so at least he'll leave something behind. My younger brother, so far as I can discern, won't leave jack shit behind. I've produced 16 books and probably millions of other written words, plus whatever you guys decide I'll leave behind by way of a homeland for our people. Now, if it wasn't for my children, the entire Covington line would have died out. Now, I attribute this, frankly, to the fact that I was cut loose at 17 and forced to fend for myself. From what I gather from many of our movement people, they have a very similar family situation to themselves. The post-war baby boom was probably the last big wave of white births in human history. Unless, of course, we can screw our courage to the sticking point and win our Northwest Republic. The baby boom, my brother's generation and mine, simply hasn't reproduced itself because we're too corrupted with liberalism, capitalist luxury, buggery, feminism, and narcissism. We wallowed in luxury for almost 70 years, but that era is over now, and it's time to pay the piper. If we don't get our act together, the piper's fee may well be our racial extinction. Right, time for our first music break. 2 weeks ago, I had a sort of musical theme for the show, specifically Confederate Civil War music. Everybody seemed to enjoy that, and so I'll be doing more music themes in future podcasts. Since we in the movement have such a problem with depression and demoralization, this week's theme will be Depression and Demoralization. You might call this week's theme Music to Slit Your Wrists by three of the most thoroughly depressing songs I could find. We'll start off with Mike Cross.
And now it's time for something grim and gory and bloody. Let me bum you out. Good evening to you, mister, the bounty hunter said. You don't know me, but I know there's a price upon your head. I know you're wanted, dead or alive, that's what the posters say. But I never shoot a man at night when he ain't had time to pray. So I'll give you until sunrise tomorrow, my friend, before I come to shoot you down and bring your body in. I warn you that I do my work quite well with gun or knife. I've tracked down many a man, I've taken many a life. Father, do not mourn for me, mother, do not weep. Whatever a man soweth, that also shall he reap. I spent a long and sleepless night with fear upon my breast, trying to get ready for my morning duel with death. I hid up in a hayloft out on the edge of town, and at sunrise the bounty hunter came to shoot me down. I fired down the bounty hunter standing in the street. He raised his gun and fired around the shots back up at me. He hit my chest and shoulder and my gun flew from my hand. Now I'm trapped up in this hayloft, a wounded unarmed man. Father, do not mourn for me, mother, do not weep. Whatever a man soweth, that also shall be reaped. The bounty hunter holds his fire and hollers up at me. Come out and take it like a man, I'll make it quick and clean. I know my time is running out and there's no way I can stall. So I reach and grab the pitchfork that's hanging on the wall. My body arches as I stretch and face the rising sun. And I feel like a warrior's bow, freshly carved and strung. I launch my body through the air and the pitchfork in my hand stabs the bounty hunter through the chest, pins him to the sand.
my muscles start to rust, my thoughts are growing cold, while Gabriel and Satan shoot craps for my
Well, I got a treat for you guys. This week, we have our first listener MP3 submission for Radio Free Northwest. This is from Ted in Alabama, and he's referring to a question I addressed on last week's Radio Free Northwest.
Hi, it's Ted. I'm the guy on your blog who loves Kiki. Mr. Covington, thanks for your reply, and I heard your broadcast. I hope this is not a case of my just being so undereducated that I just don't get it. At the risk of trying your patience, allow me to rephrase the question about sustainability. As it happens, I'm a relative newcomer to the movement, and as I took in books such as The Fame of a Dead Man's Deeds and The Brigade, also happened to take in The Long Emergency by Howard Kunstler. And thus, it should come as no surprise that I have come to believe that our beloved race is threatened in more ways than one. Hopefully I'm not causing you to have to repeat too much of what has already been said. What is percolating in my mind, I think, is synergistic. I could be wrong, but bear with me. Let's say it is a given that we should pack our bags and head to the Northwest. The question still remains, where exactly? Now, in light of Kunstler's book, we should first of all not move to any suburb. When $10 a gallon gas comes, all real estate in the suburbs will become worthless. People will no longer be able to afford the commute. The land that will become valuable will be the good farmland surrounding small towns. Obviously, there will be no food in the supermarkets anymore because the trucks will have stopped delivering. Secondly, according to Kunstler, we don't want to move into a skyscraper, nothing over 7 stories tall. When the elevators no longer function, the roofs will start to leak for lack of repair, and this will doom the entire structure. More worthless real estate. Since almost all fertilizer and pesticide are currently made from petroleum products. We must know about such things as how to restore depleted soil and how to keep bees. We must know about animal husbandry, holistic healing, midwifery, and small-scale manufacturing of trade goods. Some people may scoff at this, but educated people have been warning about the end of the era of cheap gas for years. A study of human history shows that the planet can support about 1 billion people under natural conditions, and only cheap oil has made the population boom possible. So about 6 billion people are about to be culled as a matter of necessity. Deadly serious prospect. Another thing we want to be sure of is moving to a place with a guarantee of running water, a gravity flow system. Food production will be the top priority, so we need some hippie technology, such as how to grow edible mushrooms on tree trunks or sawdust, how to make soy foods and soy dairy products. We need thousands of fruit trees on the way to maturity. Well, you might say, it might not be as bad as all that, but then again, it might be, so shouldn't intelligent white folk be prepared for anything? And once in our small towns, why not elect a state representative or two, and why not a sheriff? Participating in democracy is as American as apple pie, right? As far as being attacked by what is left of the Jew government, why would they bother? They're going to have enough problems in the big cities with skyrocketing crime and murder rioting. Why bother with simple small farmers? But of course, any small town has a right to protect its citizenry from marauding bands of starving monkeys, so I'm sure we will all be armed and deputized. Perhaps there will also be an NVA state militia. People keep wondering, when will the spark come and from where? Kunstler explains simply, it will come from $10 a gallon gasoline. $10 a gallon gas could happen this year or next. Strife in the Middle East could lead to the blocking of the Strait of Hormuz, or the stock market could crash in September, or war could erupt in Korea. So we had better hope that the spark comes later rather than sooner, because we are woefully unprepared and almost totally ignorant of survival skills. Again, I thank you for your kind attention, and I hope I have not wasted your time. Hopefully I have offered at least some new food for thought. I hope millions do come to the new homeland, but I envision us in rural America once again, in our natural spiritual setting of small communities. Also, I hope you can feel another novel coming on. And I'm still wondering, do we have a target area which has most of the characteristics which I have outlined. And finally, I just wanted to say, I have bought 4 of your books through Amazon, and I intend to get more, especially more copies of The Brigade to hand out. Surely, sir, you must have more than 2 dimes to rub together. I can't seem to stop pecking at my keyboard lately. Maybe I should try to write a book. But I'm just an undereducated country boy, burned out, don't know much. The one other thing I would like to say is that to be loved as Ronald Reagan was loved, we must speak what is in the hearts of the people. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. If disgust, resentment, and hatred are in the hearts of the people, then we must speak it. Hitler was not only the beloved of his people, he was practically worshipped because the people thought he is speaking what is in our hearts. Perhaps we need to pound it home to Obama. Mr. Obama, finish putting up this wall on our border. Man this wall. We need a Berlin-style double wall on the Mexican border with a no man's land in between.
Yes, Ted, as I said last week, I am familiar with James Howard Kuntzler. I read his blog regularly. His economic stuff is so good that I occasionally even reprint his material on the Thought Crime blog. The problem is that, like so many Jews and neocons and conservatives, he's all economy and no race. The essence of the problem facing us today is racial, not economic. Once you solve the racial problem, most of the economic problems will pretty much take care of themselves. You have to understand that the origin of the economic issues in today's world is also racial, although you do have to look pretty deep sometimes to find those origins. Basically, it's a matter of producers versus parasites, of too few people paying the taxes and too many people eating the taxes. The operative word here is unsustainable. A classic example is the subprime mortgage mess, which goes back to 1993 under the Clintons, when the regime pressured banks and mortgage companies into lending money to huge numbers of blacks and illegal aliens whom common sense should have told everyone would never ever be able to pay them back. Then the U.S. economy went south when capitalist corporations discovered the effect on their bottom line of importing large numbers of cheap third world laborers. And after that, they hit on the idea of simply shipping the jobs themselves overseas to third world countries where they could pay even less. In addition to all the deadbeat blacks and Mexicans who were defaulting on their mortgages right, left, and center, now normal white people were losing their jobs to outsourcing, and they couldn't pay their mortgages anymore, so the whole bubble eventually collapsed, and the rest is history. Yeah, it's a little bit more complicated than that, but essentially that's what happened. Race is at the bottom of it all, which is why any purely economic approach to our problems is bound to fail. Our Northwest migration is not primarily economic in nature, it is racial, and that means that we can't look at things purely from an economic perspective, nor do I mind going over all this again. Look, guys, let me say this again. I know that sometimes I sound really patronizing, and it sounds like I'm talking down to you, but believe me, that's not my intention. Guys, we need to internalize all this, and we need to get it straight in our minds, because we have to know what the hell we're doing here, and you can't know what you're doing if you don't know why. Now, Ted, all this stuff about organic gardens and fruit trees and growing mushrooms on stumps is all very well and good. Fine, I've got no problem with it, and best of luck to you on the mushroom thing. I mean that, but you're committing the same fundamental mistake that so many of our people make and which has cost so many of us so many years in prison or even our lives. People, we have to lose this idea that we will be allowed by the system to unplug ourselves from the TV and the shopping mall and separate ourselves from all the madness and the filth of democracy. We will not be. Ted, you ask, why would the regime bother to hunt us down and destroy any such effort we make? The simple answer is because they hate us, but it's a little bit more complicated than that. What Obama and his court Jews are trying to impose on us all is social democracy, as it's called, which is a form of Marxist socialism. You might call it communism light. The Brave New World, as Aldous Huxley called it. But the problem with communism light, or any other kind of communism, is that it contradicts basic human nature. The only way it'll work in any country or society, the only way you can get human beings to do it and live under it, is through imposing it by force. Marxism in practice doesn't work, it never has, and communist dictatorships from Stalin to Obama have never been able to find a workaround for that one massively inconvenient fact. It doesn't work. What this means in practice is that communism light very quickly becomes the hard stuff, complete with secret police, massive seizure of all private property and assets, and concentration camps. We're already starting to see that in this country. The so-called bailouts were basically excuses to nationalize the banking system, and Obamacare is basically a scheme to seize wealth from white people and redistribute it to black and brown people in the form of free health care. This is what happened in Chile until the army stepped in and cacked Allende. And this is what's happening right now in Venezuela. Hopefully the army or somebody will step in down there in Caracas and waste Hugo Chavez as well. The only way that any American version of the liberals' Brave New World will ever work is if everybody participates, either voluntarily or by force, because the Brave New World of the liberals is so utterly repugnant to the human spirit that if you give people an out, they will all eventually take it, and nobody will be left in the wonderful new paradise for people like Rahm Emanuel and Arianna Huffington and Al Franken and John Stewart to lord it over and feel superior to. And we can't have that now, can we? Ted, I get it. Believe me, I do. There are a lot of people out there who share your dream. I know. I talk to them online every day. You want to create Beaver Cleaverville. The white man has a long pastoral history of living on small farmsteads and in very small towns, which provide a few simple goods and services. It's a good way of life, one that's natural to us. I understand that. It was like that for the first 150 years or so in this country before capitalism and the Jews began economically squeezing us all into the cities where we could be more easily controlled and they could profit from our labor. And for many generations, white Americans have been seeking some way to escape back into this wonderful time that we seem to remember in our chromosomes. But we can't. Folks, the clock runs forward. Always. It cannot be turned back. Because, Ted, if anyone ever did succeed in creating Beaver Cleaverville in some small valley here in Idaho or in Alabama or anywhere else, eventually the lumbering thugs in the body armor with the automatic weapons would come. They would make up some excuse like they did with the Branch Davidians or the Texas Mormons or the Weaver family. United States Marshals and FBI will come in the dawn. They will cut down your fruit trees, and they will stomp your moss-grown mushrooms into the ground with their boots. They will kill your dog, and they will drag you screaming out of your little cabin in chains. They will dress you in an orange jumpsuit and throw you into a hideous place where you'll spend your days doing slave labor for corporations that rent you by the hour from the state, and you will spend your nights being butt-fucked by niggers. That is the way that the United States of America punishes anyone who tries to separate themselves from the brave new world of Bill and Hillary Clinton and Barack Hussein Obama. Ask Bill White. Ask Edgar Steele. Ask the Huttery Militia. And if you dare to resist, their snipers will gun you down in your own doorway like they did to Vicky Weaver. And they will burn your home to the ground with you and your family inside, just like they did with the Branch Davidians. I know it's been 17 years since Waco, but to me it's like yesterday, and I know all of you must have seen the video footage. I don't know how anybody can watch that burning compound with the children inside all those years ago and not get the message. But apparently an awful lot of our people don't. Ted, we can indeed build such a white paradise here in the Pacific Northwest, but we first have a revolution to win. There can be no hope for white people without a nation-state of our own, only for us. We can indeed create your Beaver Cleaverville many times over, but only once we have removed the evil people who now rule us and taken our political and racial destiny back into our own hands. Guys, if you learn nothing else from anything I have ever written or said, burn this into your brains. Nothing can be accomplished without state power in our hands, not theirs. Somehow, sometime, we must find within ourselves the courage and the will to confront the powers of darkness and defeat them. There's no way out, no matter how we may try to wriggle and rationalize our way off the hook. At some point, we fight, or someday we die, all of us. Now, Ted, speaking of novel number 5, the one that'll detail the first 50 years of the Northwest Republic's existence, I don't mean to be constantly tantalizing you folk with hints, because I'm dead serious. It most likely won't ever be written. Not until I can get some help up here and cut my daily NF workload at least in half, so I'll have time to write another book. And yes, I do have a workload, but we won't get into that again. Anyway, last night I was doing something else, and all of a sudden, out of the blue, a title for novel number 5 hit me. Freedom's Sons. Now, that's actually not original. It's the title of an Irish rebel song about the 1916 Easter Rebellion by Tommy Makem. But I think it would make a great book title for that period of the mythos, the series, whatever you want to call it. Now, that's a bad sign. Generally, the way this works is once I get a book title in my head, it's kind of born whether I like it or not. My brain starts working on autopilot, and all of a sudden, I start getting characters and scenes and plot lines popping up into my consciousness. So who knows, Ted? Maybe one day you'll get your novel number 5 after all. At the moment, I honestly don't see how. But one thing I've learned in the movement is never say never again. Second music break. In February of 1692, in the Highlands of Scotland, 38 men of the Clan MacDonald were murdered and 40 women and children died of exposure after their homes were burned in a village called Glencoe. The killings were carried out by their neighbors, the Campbells, on a direct order from the English King William III. That order, by the way, has been preserved, and it's now in a museum in Scotland. King William was the William of William and Mary fame, for those of you from Virginia. He is also the person that the colonial town of Williamsburg was named after. The Campbells have always had a reputation for sucking up to the English, and even to this day, they're not very popular in the Highlands. The MacDonalds were supposedly killed because they were Jacobites still loyal to the House of Stuart, and they'd refused to take a loyalty oath to the Protestant king in England, but in actual fact, there was bad blood going way back between the MacDonalds and the Campbells, and this was basically an extension of a feud going back many generations. Now, this is the Corries.
Cruel is the snow that sweeps Glencoe and covers the grave O'Donnell, and cruel was the foe that raped Glencoe and murdered the house of MacDonnell. They came in a blizzard, we offered them heat, a roof for their heads, dry shoes for their feet. We wined them and dined them, they ate all our meat, and they slept in the house of MacDonald. Oh, cruel is the snow that sweeps Glencoe and covers the grave O'Donnell, and cruel was the foe that raped Glencoe and murdered the house of MacDonald. They came from Fort William, we murdered in mind. The Campbell had orders, King William had signed. They taught to the sword these words underlined, and leave none alive called MacDonald. Oh, cruel is the snow that sweeps Glencoe and covers the grave O'Donnell, and cruel was the foe that raped Glencoe and murdered the house of MacDonald. They came in the night when the men were asleep, this band of Argyles, through snow soft and deep, like murdering foxes among helpless sheep, they slaughtered the house of MacDonald. Oh, cruel is the snow that sweeps Glencoe and covers the grave O'Donnell, and cruel was the foe that raped Glencoe and murdered the house of MacDonald. Some died in their beds at the hand of the foe, some fled in the night, were lost in the snow, some lived to accuse him, was struck the first blow, but gone was the house of MacDonald. Oh, cruel is the snow that sweeps Glencoe and covers the grave O'Donnell, and cruel was the foe that raped Glencoe and murdered the house of MacDonald. Oh, cruel is the snow that sweeps Glencoe and covers the grave O'Donnell, and cruel was the foe that raped Glencoe and murdered the house of MacDonald.
Okay, now we have the kind of question I like, one on the Northwest Constitution. Looks like some people are actually starting to read the darn thing, and for those of you who would like to, it's posted on our website at www.northwestfront.org in the About section. Now, this is from Wendy in Maryland, and although it sounds almost like a heckle, I'm assured by one of our people out there that Wendy is a serious individual, so I'll treat this as a serious question. Dear Mr. Covington, I was looking over the Northwest website section on the new Constitution. One of the major problems I have with its proposed citizenship is the rejection of people who are quote-unquote insane. They don't choose to be that way. Schizophrenics are so by genes, and war veterans get PTSD, and up north a lot of people suffer from depression from light deprivation. Whites have the highest rate of mental illness per capita over all other races. In my business, it's rare that I see a black person with schizophrenia. Almost all of them are white. There are a lot of mentally ill people on Stormfront. Ooh, touche, Mr. Black. By the way, Wendy's quite correct, not trying to be funny, but the reason why there is so little actual mental illness among blacks is that before you can be mentally ill, first you have to have a mind. White people's brains and nervous systems are far more complex than the cruder Negroid model, kind of like Linux as opposed to the old DOS. Much more complex software, and so like all complex machinery, the white brain and nerves are more high maintenance and they break down a lot more easily. Anyway, back to Wendy's email. A long time ago, when I said I worked with people with mental illness, a bunch of them came out to me privately. There are a lot of mentally ill people in the movement. The Northwest Revolution would kick out many of their best supporters, and it would drive many mentally ill people underground where they don't get help. Not a good scenario. No, Wendy, we won't kick them out. We just send them over to VNN. And no, that's not a joke. Yes, you're right. I get a lot of people emailing me who are pretty obviously playing with a deck 51, and I send them the VNN forum's internet address. I don't think Alex Linder has noticed. Anyway, getting back to your question, you're confusing the legal status of residents with that of citizens. Any white man or woman from any nation can reside in the Northwest American Republic. It'll be our racial homeland, after all, and that's the primary purpose of bringing it into existence. However, citizenship is a horse of a different color. Citizenship confers political rights and also demands responsibilities. In most countries, citizenship is something you're born with, and when you reach the age of 18 or 21 or whatever, you get to vote, never mind whether you're a mathematical genius, a drug addict, a criminal, a lunatic, a brain surgeon, or just plain dumb as a bag of hammers, you still get one vote. Now, in a racially homogeneous and highly educated society like we used to have in this country, that system can work. It worked here for a while, but then it broke down for reasons which should be so obvious I won't even bother to go into them. Now, you want to see the result of democracy and one man, one vote, with no responsibility and no standard of political competency? Look around you, Wendy. Citizenship in the Northwest Republic is something you earn. You will notice at the end of the document, we have a Bill of Rights, which is very similar to the one in the United States Constitution, except that the U.S. Constitution's Second Amendment is our first article, since the right to keep and bear arms is the one that secures all the others. But you will also note that the Bill of Rights is followed by a Bill of Responsibilities, which is something the United States Constitution unfortunately lacks. More's a pity. If the Founding Fathers had thought to include a Bill of Responsibilities as well, a lot of painful history would have been spared. In the Northwest American Republic, citizenship is the reward of responsibility fulfilled. Fulfilled how? Well, that has yet to be determined. Our Constitution, after all, is still only a draft. My own view is that a young man or woman should get their first citizenship, third-class citizenship with one vote, on successful completion of their national service. 2 years in the military for a young man or woman, 2 years in the labor service or some other designated state body for young women who choose not to serve in the military. I think it's only fair that at that point you get your first vote. You've earned it. Promotion to second and first-class citizenship, with 2 and 3 votes respectively, will depend on a lot of factors. Now let's say that after the army or labor service, a young man or woman goes to medical school and becomes a doctor. He or she has become a more valuable member of the community than the guy who works in a video rental store, if such places still exist after the revolution. It's not just the value of their service to the community, it's also the level of intelligence they've demonstrated and the degree of education they've received, which will make such people better equipped to understand and make decisions on complex political issues. This idea about everybody being equal is fine and dandy, a noble sentiment in theory, but it simply isn't true in practice and never has been. In any normal society other than outright communism, the rewards one gets out of life are more or less proportional to what one puts into it, and society determines the nature and the degree of those rewards. It's always been like that. With all its talk about equality, American society rewards doctors and engineers doctors and scientists and so on with more money. The Republic, which will hopefully not be a completely materialistic and money-centered society, will reward them with more input into the workings of the state and society as a whole. This will also encourage more active participation by such persons. Now, let's face it, most really intelligent and strong people in America these days won't have a damn thing to do with politics or the American system, because it's so obviously corrupt and full of idiots and creeps and thieves. Now, that's part of the problem. Good people are actually discouraged from taking part in politics. We want to encourage them, and our multi-tiered citizenship structure is part of that. But that doesn't mean that you have to be an egghead in order to get second or first class citizenship. Far from it. I personally believe, for example, that any woman who has two children should get second class, and three or more should get first class citizenship with extra votes, because she now has a stake in society and she can hopefully be trusted to make decisions in the interests of her children. I personally think there should be some kind of time and grade arrangement, so that every 10 years or so you get a citizenship upgrade, as long as you don't blot your copybook by robbing a liquor store or poisoning your wife or something really serious like that. That means that the votes of older and presumably wiser people will count more than those who are just out of the military and just starting out in life, and who still need to get some years and some life experience on them yet to make the best and wisest decisions. It's not anyone's intention to deny young people the vote, and I am not saying that. They won't be. But in view of what happened on November the 4th, 2008, I think it's a good idea to give older and more experienced people more of a say in how things are run. And remember, this is not a permanent imbalance. Young third classes will grow older and get more experience, and their time for second and first class citizenship will come as well. Basically, Wendy, like a lot of our Northwest Constitution, these provisions are designed to try and correct where the United States went off the tracks back around 1861. It's designed to prevent some kind of white Obama from being elected president of the Northwest Republic, by which I mean somebody totally unqualified and unsuitable to run the country who just wins by flashing a toothy grin on TV like so many American politicians do. Now, hopefully the rest of the Constitution would stop such a person, like the demand that he or she be a military veteran and a party member. Consider it a kind of checks and balances thing. Of course, we could always go back to the constitution of the ancient Roman Republic, the entire of which was deliberately designed to prevent a single man from assuming total power. Sorry, I know I'm rambling off topic again. Now, Wendy, in order to fulfill these conditions, to serve in the army, be functional in society, you kind of have to be sane. By that I mean, you can't think you're Napoleon, you can't think aliens from Alpha Centauri are beaming microwave messages to your brain, nothing like that. You can't be obsessive compulsive and be writing the number 8 all over the walls, you can't be hebephrenic and go to the bathroom in your pants, you can't run around stabbing people with scissors. I have genuine sympathy for people like that, Wendy, people who really are sick in their head. I honestly think I'd rather battle cancer than something like that. But sorry, Wendy, we can't let genuinely mentally disturbed people vote or sit on juries. That's just the way it's got to be. If it helps, Wendy, I don't think it will be all that much of a problem, because I honestly don't think mental illness will be anywhere near the problem it is in the United States today. Now, when people grow up in a sane, stable, racially homogenous society without all the stresses and strains and unnatural gibberish that goes on under political correctness, a society that encourages family values and provides genuine opportunity and a chance for happiness as opposed to mere wealth, I think you'll be amazed at how many of these mental health issues disappear. Third music break. You know, I get a little bit tired of niggers and liberals moaning and groaning about the middle passage of the slave ships, so forth and so on. Yeah, it was grim, and I agree it shouldn't have happened, although not for the reasons liberals would claim. I say blacks should never have been brought here from the very first, in any manner or for any reason. But the fact is that during the 18th and 19th century, that wonderful England that my brother says stands for civilization shipped hundreds of thousands of white people across the ocean to America and later to Australia in chains, in conditions which were just as lethal and vile as any slave ship. Yes, Virginia, there were white slaves, hundreds of thousands of them, and that's what they were, slaves. And they were used to build the British Empire from the Cape Town breakwater to draining the Okefenokee Swamp. The American state of Georgia was founded as a penal colony, as well as the entire nation of Australia. In 1803, Ireland underwent one of its many futile revolts against English rule, led by a man named Robert Emmet, whose statue stands on St. Stephen's Green in Dublin. Most of Emmet's fellow insurrectionists were transported to Australia. No one knows how many, but at least several hundred. Of all the hundreds who were shipped out, one man alone survived his term and made it back to Ireland many years later. We don't know his name, but he left us this song. This is Hair of the Dog.
From the sweet town of Derry, for Astree bound, if we didn't all drown, the marks of our fetters we carry. From the rusty iron chains we cried for a raise, the good women we lived in sorrow. As the mainsails unfurled, our curses we heard of the English and thoughts of tomorrow. From the mouth of the fog it fell ill to the soil, for down below decks we were lying. Well, Dorothy screamed, driven out from a dream of a vision of old Robert Dunn. As the sun burned the crew, we dished up the goo. Dan O'Connor was down with the fever. 60 rebels today bound for Botany Bay. How many do each say deceiver? Whoa, I wish I was back home in Derry. Whoa, I wish I was back home in Derry. Cursing the hell is our bow, fuck the swell. Our ship dance like Mars in the fair. White horses rode high as the devil passed by, taking souls to Hades by July. 5 weeks out to sea, we went down for three, bearing our comrades each morning. And in our own slime, we were lost in time, and this night without our end. Back home in Derry. Oh, I wish I was back home in Derry. Van Diemen's line is a hill for a man to end out his whole life in slavery. Where the climate is raw and the gun makes a law, neither wind nor rain care for bravery. 20 years have gone by, I've ended my bonds. My comrades go swore beside me. A rebel I came, and I'm still the same. On a cold and as a night, you will find me. Yeah. Oh, I wish I was back home in Derry.
I'd like now to address one of the many criticisms that's been directed against the Northwest Imperative and against me personally with varying degrees of sincerity. I'm not talking about the Lords of V Bulletin or other movement kooks, but real people who are genuinely disturbed and afraid and concerned. Now, they're worried about what one person referred to as my shouting for violence. They are afraid that any association with myself or with the Northwest Front will, quote-unquote, get them into trouble. Now, folks, I'm not going to lie to you. That's possible. Like all tyrannies, the Obama regime regularly practices guilt by association. Ask those Huttery militia people. The FBI didn't just arrest the one individual their informant set up. They also arrested seven other hapless people who had no idea about any so-called conspiracy and probably still don't know what hit them. Okay, look, I think most of you get the Northwest idea, or if not, you're starting to get it. So let me run this down for you guys again. I want to tell you just what I've been doing over the past 10 years. My main role in all this springs from my authorship of the four Northwest Independence novels. These novels are not primarily works of fiction. The purpose of fiction is to entertain. The four Northwest novels are political polemics that have been deliberately written from the ground up with a specific purpose in mind. Ever put together a jigsaw puzzle? Then you know that the first requirement is that you need the cover of the box so that you can see what the picture you're trying to assemble looks like when it's completed. Now, for decades, the white racial resistance movement in this country just sort of drifted without a plan and without a clue. My purpose in writing the four Northwest novels was to show you people the cover of the box, to show you what the finished product will look like. Yes, there are also elements of a how-to manual in there, and I make no apology for that. They're part of the cover of the puzzle box, showing you how the many pieces fit together. Now, I've been accused of trying to get white people into trouble by telling them what to do. That's not the case. In my novels, I am not telling white people what they should do. I am showing them what they should be. For all the many elements in my novels, everything from explosions and assassinations to high political theory to teenaged romance, these books are not about their actual plot lines. They're not about criminal activity. They're not about violence. They're not even about race and politics so much. They are about character. Do you guys get what I'm saying here? The Northwest novels are novels about white character, what it has been in the past and what it has to be in the future. What my individual characters like Cody Brock, Shane Ryan, and Zach Hatfield do in these books is not important. What's important is why they do it. My purpose in writing those novels was twofold. First and foremost, I wanted to convey to our people a sense of possibility about the coming Northwest American Republic. Now, one of the impediments to our progress seems to be a general desire to fast forward the tape, to find ourselves suddenly in a position where all the hard, inconvenient, and dangerous and expensive preliminary work has already been done by somebody else. No one can do that, but I can give our people a brief glimpse of what the fast-forwarded tape might look like during the later parts of the movie, so to speak. My object here is for readers to see and internalize the possibility of victory. To achieve this, I've resurrected some ancient themes and concepts that haven't been seen in American literature for some time. Most notably, the image of strong white males and a few strong white females fighting against the tyrannical and oppressive American regime in actual combat with weapons in their hands. The image of the white male fighting against the United States government with a weapon in his hand is an incredibly powerful one. It has an irresistible appeal to white readers, especially young white readers. And the only reason that there hasn't been much more buzz about the Northwest novels than there has been is that only a handful of people know that they exist. Now, if I can ever somehow persuade the 1,500 or so people on our present email list, plus all the listeners to Radio Free Northwest, to leave their present passive mode where they simply sit and watch or listen and actively promote the Northwest novels on the internet and everywhere else, they could easily go viral. And all of a sudden, the Northwest series will have a million readers. It'll be a kind of a racist Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter phenomenon, and the Northwest movement's propaganda and financial problems will be pretty much solved, and we can move on to the next step. Now, the Northwest imperative would be catapulted by that into the big time. It's just getting that first few thousand people or so out of the passive mode and getting them to start actually doing some keyboard tapping and posting and chatting. That's the problem. I haven't found the right words yet. I haven't found the ignition key, but I will. Secondly, with these books, I'm attempting to do something which I'm amazed to observe has thus far never even been attempted by anyone in the so-called movement, not ever before. I want to provide us all with some kind of vision of our own post-revolutionary future as a white nation. Now, we need to see where we're going if we're ever going to get there. As well done and significant as the Turner Diaries is, its vision of the post-revolutionary Aryan future is sketchy at best. The book ends in a nuclear holocaust, not a reconstructed and revitalized world. We don't want to blow up the existing world. We want to make a new one for our people. I believe that these novels can fulfill their primary purpose, and that's giving the pioneers of the Northwest Independence Movement that sense of possibility I spoke of, not just a victory, but the possibility of a better world to come, if we're willing to pay the price for it here and now. I am letting you get a glimpse of the prize itself, letting you know that it exists, or it can exist, if we can find within ourselves the courage to change our thinking and to stiffen our spines. Now finally, and this is what makes everybody so nervous about me, I seek to remove the taboo on speech, a certain kind of speech, so as to prevent a taboo on a certain kind of thought. Direct action to end tyranny is like the word nigger. Politically correct society doesn't allow us to say nigger because it doesn't want us thinking nigger, and eventually people become so afraid of retaliation that they censor themselves from even thinking the word nigger for fear that they'll blurt it out, and that's what the regime wants. Direct action is the only thing that will bring about real change in this society. You either get that or you don't. And I think most of us do, down deep in the privacy of our own thoughts. We're just too terrified and paranoid to say it. I break that taboo. And like any time when someone breaks a taboo, it makes our more timid and conservative people nervous and uncomfortable. Well, hang on to your hats, guys, because the wildest ride is yet to come. Because you know that world I describe in my Northwest novels? It's going to happen. Okay, maybe it won't happen exactly like I describe in the books, but something more or less like that world is coming right at you down the track, like a runaway freight train, thanks to Barack Hussein Obama and a bunch of crazy Jews and a bunch of greedy bankers. Now, you conservative folks out there have got two choices. Either jump on the Northwest train as it roars by, or leap the hell off the tracks. You need to make your choice now, because that train's getting closer by the second as we speak. Well, our time is up now, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha and Iman. Freedom.
Thank you.